Hi everyone, I'm Stephen Downs. Welcome to another episode in Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. We're in Module 5. We're talking about approaches to ethics. And in the previous video, I talked about approaches to ethics in overview. Now, in these next few videos, I'm going to talk about a number of ethical theories in more detail, and the first one will be our look at virtue and character. Now, I'm sensitive to the fact that this could be an entire course, and instead it's a short, maybe 1 hour segment of this course. I'm also sensitive to the idea that listening to me talk about virtue and character for an hour might not be the greatest way you want to spend your afternoon. And if that's so, that's fair enough. Wait for the transcript. It will be available in the course. The reason why I'm doing it this way is because I want to combine a bit of the background research, a bit of the preparation for these things, but also a bit of the je ne sais quoi that comes from talking about these things off the top of my head. Because what I'm doing as I assemble this course is I'm not simply pulling together research on various topics. I mean, I am doing that, but I've been working on philosophy and ethics for the last 40 years. So, there's a sense in which I'm pulling together research, but there's a more important sense, I think, in which I'm drawing on my own depth of experience and knowledge, not only of ethics, but of technology and of learning and even of journalism and other aspects of my life to bring together an overarching view. And that's going to be characteristic of this presentation as well. Now, I mean, I could just read an encyclopedia article, and I consulted a number along with primary sources in preparation for this video, but it wouldn't be very useful because it wouldn't really have any context. And I want to take this idea and place it into a contemporary context and also a context based in this course. So that's why I'm doing it this way. And I think you should take these videos not so much as me offering a lecture on a subject. I think that would be the wrong way to think of them. I want you to think of them as me setting myself up with a set of resources, including a set of slides, but I'm also working from some text here as well, and some background information. Setting myself up and then working my way through these ideas as a first draft, actually more like a second or third draft of what will eventually become a more comprehensive work. If you view it that way, if you view this really as me thinking about these subjects for myself rather than me telling you about these subjects so that you can remember them, I think that might be a more productive way of looking at these videos. Okay, I've probably said things, well, I know I've said things sort of like this already in the past, and I may come back to this message in the future, but I think it's a helpful way of understanding what I'm up to here. So, but I'm also trying to make kind of a neat resource too. So, you know, I'm going to try to do the video production values and all of that. But, you know, I'm not National Geographic. I can't pull off the sound and the moving images and I'm working on zero budget. So, you know, what do you expect? Okay. Virtue and character. So, ethics, as they say, in this perspective, is in the first instance the study of virtue in a person. As perhaps revealed by a person's actions, or perhaps as revealed by how they conduct themselves in society. But what is virtue? That's one of those horrible questions. It's a bit like asking you, but what is good or what is ethically right? Well, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy says, and I quote, "A virtue is an excellent trait of character. It is a disposition well entrenched in its possessor, something that, as we say, goes all the way down, unlike habit, such as being a tea drinker, to notice, expect, value, feel, desire, choose, act, and react in certain characteristic ways." Now, we could pull a lot out of that definition. When we say, for example, it's a disposition, that brings to mind Gilbert Ryle's behaviorist theory of mind, in which, people's character amounts to nothing more, he says, than dispositions. When we say it's well entrenched in its possessor, we sort of wonder whether there's an appeal here being made to the essence of a person. Or perhaps we're talking about a person as something that has deep kinds of formations, maybe deep neural patterns or something like that. When we draw a distinction between a mere habit and a virtue, again, we're sort of trying to distinguish that which is, shall we say, an accidental property of a person and that which is an essential property of a person. But we need to be careful about this, because the core attribute of the essential is that it's unchangeable. And that creates intractable problems for virtue as a theory of ethics. The nature of virtue is usually characterized by describing the different traits of virtue. And we will do that in a little bit. Things like honesty, frugality, piety, humility, caring, courage, etc., right? But the way virtue theory works is that it's not defined by these traits. It's the old dodge that Socrates used to use a lot. Somebody would say to him, "Well, what is the nature of justice?" And somebody would answer, "Well, it's giving people what is their due. It is being fair in adjudication." And Socrates will say, "Well, no, these are just examples of justice, but they're not what justice is." And so the same with virtue, right? These are examples of virtue, but they're not what virtue is. And again, so we have this sort of idea that there's a thing at the core, which is virtue, and then these characteristics spring off of that. Almost as though they are aspects of some sort of sense of perfection. So there's the idea of what the perfect person might be, and then these character traits, which are representative of a perfect person, but aren't what define a perfect person. The achievement of virtue is represented as the highest ethical principle. And it's essentially tied up with the development of character. And that's why I've put virtue and character together in this section. Aristotle might say that the achievement of virtue is a lifetime task. You spend a lifetime building your character. There's an old Taoist trope that goes, or an old Taoist meme, which is probably not even accurate, right? Watch what you say, because then it's what you believe. Watch what you believe, because then it's your character. Watch what your character, because then it's your destiny. I don't think Lao Tzu ever said any such thing. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. But that gets at kind of the idea, right? That we can, by saying the right thing, doing the right thing, develop these virtues in ourselves. And it's an act of will. And we'll come back to that. It's the opposite of what might be called the weakness of will. It's the opposite of our succumbing to the temptation to indulge, to be intemperate, dishonest, violent, capricious, all of these things that, I guess, are not virtues. the achievement of virtue can be thought of as something like self-formation. And here we see this reflected in modern writers such as Michel Foucault, who talks about, and I quote, self-formation as an ethical subject, a process in which the individual delimits that part of himself that will form the object of his moral practice, defines his position relative to the precept he will follow, and decides on a certain mode of being that will serve as his moral goal. That's a fancy way, quoted from the Internet Encyclopedia of Philosophy, of saying, you know, what kind of person do I want to be, and how do I go about developing that in myself? I might say, for example, I want to be the kind of person that people trust. And then, as a result, I undertake the sorts of actions and cultivate that aspect of my personality that engenders trust. But it can be a lot more basic than that. I remember once, way back when I was working with the Graduate Students Association, somebody once said of me, within my hearing, oh yes, Stephen is always on time. Which was a bit surprising to me, because I had never really thought of that. But then I realized, yeah, I want to be thought of as the sort of person who's always on time. And then I began to cultivate that aspect of my character, to be the sort of person who is there in his chair, ready to start when the meeting starts, or the event starts, or whatever. It's not an accidental thing. And it's not even something that's in itself inherently a virtue. I mean, nobody lists always being on time as one of the lists of virtues. But it's this aspect of character that reveals the deeper character that I was trying to cultivate. I don't know if I was successful, but, you know, I went through that process in my life. And it's something that isn't obviously limited to me, and it is something that we think about or have thought about more, perhaps, in recent years. There's a phenomenon of the idea of someone, quote, working on myself. And, you know, in popular culture, we generally think of this as applying to women, but it certainly does not apply exclusively to women. And we can ask things like, if you are working on yourself, are you considering these points when you say, I am working on me? Are you working on yourself? Or are you maintaining your happiness? Are you somewhere in the middle? Or you just do not know? It doesn't matter where you are in your journey. And that's part of it. The idea that we're going from where we were to where we're going to be. Excuse me. The idea of an older, less good version of myself to a more ideal version of myself. It partly has to do with virtue. And it partly has to do with our relations with each others and whether we're ready to interact with others. And it partly has to do with our broader standing in society. What kind of person do I want to be in society? So, the virtues. The virtues in the context of excuse me, general theories of ethics aren't not so much that sort of thing, but more a normative sort of thing. And by normative, what I mean here is that the idea of the virtue tells you how to behave or what to do. From a BBC documentary, I pulled this. Virtue ethics teaches the following. An action is only right if it is an action that a virtuous person would carry out in the same circumstance. A virtuous person is a person who acts virtuously. A person acts virtuously if they possess and live the virtues. A virtue is a moral characteristic that a person needs to live well. And you can sort of see here that it's telling you what you should do, but not specifically what you should do. How you should live, but not specifically how you should live. Even what kind of person you should be, but not specifically what kind of person you should be. So it's normative in the sense that it's telling us, what constitutes a right action. But it's vague in the description of what a right action is. And that's also listed as one of the criticisms of virtue ethics, that it's not prescriptive in that way. There's a couple of things here worth noting. And first of all, is the characterization of a right action as something that somebody would do in the same circumstances. And so there's an element of counterfactual reasoning here. There's an element of asking yourself, what would be the state in the closest possible world where I am in fact a virtuous person? Or where a virtuous person is standing in my place instead of me. And so that's going to create difficulties. Certainly it creates a need for something like a possible world semantics so we can understand what's happening in possible worlds and then apply it to this world. But we can do that. We have evidence of being able to do that. And there's also the sense in which, being a virtuous person isn't like laying down a set of rules or principles, but rather it's more like recognizing what the right sort of thing is to do. And I have a lot to say about knowledge as recognition in other forms and other formats. And I think that kind of reasoning applies here as well. A virtual person wouldn't follow a principle. They would just recognize or just know what the correct action is here. I've brought in, on the other side of this slide, a discussion of virtue ethics as it applies to research and research ethics. Again, applying virtue ethics as a normative approach, telling people what to do, without being a prescriptive approach. So we have basically a collection of factors. Science as a social practice and ethical principles of research, empirical studies on researchers and their assessments of virtues, other virtues evidence, ethics studies, and one's personal values, bringing this all together to create something like virtuous research. And then these are applied against the values and norms of the Institute of Science and the externalized ethical guidelines and principles in research. And so it's almost like we have this, I don't want to say us versus them, because that's not how it's supposed to work out, but this internal sense of what a virtuous researcher would do measured up against the framework defined by society and ethics boards as to what constitutes ethical research. And so the definitions of what constitute ethical research by, say, research ethics boards aren't taken as definitive, but rather are taken as a standard of measuring against one's own virtuous sense. At least that's how I take that. And I think there's something to it. I don't think we've got the whole story here, but I think we've got perhaps part of the story, and I'll refer back to some of this discussion as we get to the later points, later modules of the course. So let's think for a moment then, what are the virtues? because this is where almost all discussion of virtue ethics ends up. And just to introduce that, I've brought forward here, this is a representation of St. Thomas Aquinas on virtues. Thomas Aquinas is a very well-known philosopher from the Catholic tradition. But this is his position on virtues represented as a UML document, which is a type of diagram that computer scientists use in order to display the flow of data and information across a system. And so we have first principles, practical reason, characters feeding in to the concept of virtue, and human good and choice mediating. And so we have the core value of virtue, whatever that is, and then we have the sub-kinds, prudence, justice, courage, temperance, and then the characterization of virtue. And, okay, I kind of get that, but it seems odd for me to think that we can represent Thomas Aquinas with a UML document, with a UML diagram. And there does seem to be something missing in that. Something to think about. So what are the virtues? Well, we'll begin with what are called the cardinal virtues. We just read them. That are the four virtues of mind and character in both classical philosophy and Christian theology. They are prudence, which includes wisdom. Justice, which could be thought of as fairness or righteousness. Fortitude, which could be thought of as courage or maybe resilience. And temperance, which could be thought of as restraint or the practice of self-control. And we could ask, are these all and only the virtues? And the answer is going to be pretty obviously no. These were taken as core, but in the 2,500 years since these were originally devised, there have been numerous variations on the theme. Probably the most well-known are Aristotle's 12 virtues. And here we have the list: bravery, temperance, generosity, truthfulness, wittiness, friendliness, being spirited, conscientious, indignant, benevolent, and industrious. And what I find interesting about this list, not to mention some of the characteristics like wittiness. Again, you wouldn't think being witty as an ethical principle, but there it is. And, you know, when you think about it, you know, it's like the theory of being successful as being, you know, the sort of person you want to sit down and have a beer with or something like that. Maybe having a beer with is the wrong example, but I think you get the idea, right? Somebody who's friendly and outgoing is somehow ethically better. So we think. And anyhow, the way Aristotle sets this up, at least in this depiction, is that there's a range. These are characteristics. On the one hand, they might be completely absent, and that's a vice. And on the other hand, we can take them to excess, and that's a vice. And being virtuous here really means finding that happy medium or the happy mean, you know, somewhere in the middle. So being brave, as opposed to being cowardly, which is the absence or the deficiency, but as opposed to being stupid or rash. You know, it's one thing to be brave. It's another thing to jump off a cliff without a parachute. That's rash. Temperance, similarly. you know, being addicted to alcohol or being addicted to food is too much. It's you know, it's a deficiency of temperance, if you will. But on the other hand, giving up food, giving up alcohol, taking these things to extreme, could also be seen as a vice. This is kind of interesting in the Greek context, because there was no shortage of ascetics in the Greek context. People experimenting with different ways of living noble lives, virtuous lives, or just philosophically consistent lives. Another way of looking at all of this is through the lens of Stoicism. And I don't like using the expression "through the lens of," but I'll use it here. It's good enough. And Stoicism, again, could be an entire course, right? But basically can be characterized by the triangle, where on the one corner, or on the one hand, we expressed the highest version of oneself from moment to moment. That's the principle of arete, be all that you can be. And on the other hand, focusing on what we control and accepting the rest as it happens. And that reminds us of that old phrase, right? Give me the knowledge to... how does that go? I'm trying to remember it. Give me the courage to change what I can change, the knowledge to... or the acceptance to not change what I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference. Something like that. You know the phrase. And so the third part of Stoicism, and the part that everybody kind of keys in on, is the idea of taking responsibility and recognizing that it's not an external situation that makes us happy or miserable, but rather our interpretation of that situation. Which is fine for the most part. But if your external situation is one in which there is utterly no food to be had, it takes quite a bit of strength of character to be happy nonetheless. You know. So, I mean, the concept of virtue is sometimes to be contrasted with the concept of having ordinary emotions in an ordinary life. These virtues aren't just limited to the Greek and Christian tradition. We find them in other traditions as well. I'll sample a few here. And again, and a whole entire course in one slide, right? So, for example, within Confucianism, we could identify the following virtues: benevolence, righteousness, propriety, wisdom, and fidelity. And that last one probably is what's most characteristic of Confucianism, because fidelity means honoring your parents, honoring your forefathers, and to a degree honoring those who you serve or those who are in authority over you. And again, that's a very hand-wavy representation of Confucianism. Taoism has a similar perspective, and you know, as you read the Tao Te Ching, you read constant references to, depending on how it's translated exactly, but the sage is this, or the sage is that. And by the sage, we can mean perhaps the philosopher, or perhaps the enlightened ruler. It depends on your perspective, right? And so here I'm quoting from Britannica, Taoist sagehood is internal, although it can be manifest in an external royalty that brings the world back to the way by means of quietism, variously called non-intervention, wu-wei, inner cultivation, nie, or Art of the Heart and Mind, Zhen Zhu. And Taoism is interesting because the virtue that it describes is, in a sense, a virtue of selflessness, so that you're not striving for wealth, you're not striving for power, but it's also a virtue of effectiveness in that if you live this way, you will acquire wealth, you will acquire power. And it's this sense of self-abnegation. It's not simply doing nothing, but rather doing something so perfectly that there is no trace of yourself in the finished work. It's like a jade carving. You don't want to see the marks made by the carver. There's a lot more to Taoism than that, but from the perspective of virtue, we can see that there are some principles that are sort of not principles, or some characteristic virtues that are not really characteristic virtues, but it's still very much a form, at least to my interpretation, of virtue ethics. Bushido, and here I can't make any claims that this is an accurate representation of Bushido because I simply don't have the background in that theory. But nonetheless, I can say, because it's right here, that these seven virtues can be described as a type of virtue ethics. So they would include things like integrity, respect, heroic courage, honor, compassion, honesty and sincerity, and duty and loyalty. Now, one of the things we should notice here is that, although it almost feels like there's a core, there isn't a core, and it almost feels like they're the same thing, they aren't the same thing, and there are certainly differences of emphasis in the different approaches to virtue. And I think that's an important aspect of this approach, and that aspect is, just what are those virtues? Keenan offers a more contemporary list. Justice, which is not simply fairness, but a requirement to treat everybody equally and impartially, if that's possible. Fidelity, which seems to contrast not well with justice, in that we should treat people closer to us with special care. Self-care, a unique responsibility to care for ourselves, which speaks again to this achievement of virtue. And then prudence, we must always consider these things. And the way he derives these, he says, as persons, we are relational in three ways: generally, specifically, and uniquely. And each of these relational ways of being demands a cardinal virtue, which are justice, fidelity, and self-care. And then there's the fourth cardinal virtue, which is prudence, which determines what constitutes the just, faithful, and self-caring way of life for an individual. It's the moderator between those three, if you will. And that's an interesting characterization of virtue because, again, none of justice, fidelity, or self-care is always going to carry the day. And we need this prudence, this idea perhaps of wisdom, knowledge, attentiveness, to actually decide how to weigh one of these or the other. So that's one way of looking at the virtues from a contemporary perspective. Here's another way: Moulin Rouge. And we don't normally think of a movie starring people like Nicole Kidman to be an example of virtue ethics, but nonetheless, there it is, promoting the virtues of truth, beauty, freedom, and love. And just to show how this rolls up into virtue ethics, this is something that I created called Mulan Ching. And it's the idea of creating a sense of virtue reflective of day-to-day life using the same methodology as the I Ching with coins. I've never really mastered the method with yarrow sticks. And so the idea is that you toss the coins, that gives you a position on the grid. And so what it is a combination of two of these four virtues. So, for example, if you roll 1-0 and then 0-1, you get freedom against beauty. And what is that? That's beautiful freedom. Beauty on freedom. Sweet liberty. No responsibilities for it. And that's an interesting way of looking at virtue as well. But the idea here is that we're seeing how these virtues are instantiated, not just in ourselves, but how we see ourselves living from day to day. And that kind of what is what the Tao Te Ching does as well. It's sometimes represented as, you know, a fortune-telling process, but I don't think it is. I think it's a way of understanding how the different virtues, how the different elements of the world come together to form different ways of seeing the world and your life and other people in ways that might be important to you. So, in contemporary times, and by contemporary times, I mean any time in the last 50 years, I suppose, the concept of virtue ethics has blossomed into a way of looking at how to do well and be well and live well generally. And I've grouped these under the heading of character and mindset. And I think of these as modern adaptations of virtue theory. And it's not hard to see the connection. Look at this diagram from George Koros, his book, The Innovator's Mindset. And look at the values that we see being described here. Empathetic, problem finders, risk takers, networked, observant, creators, resilient, and reflective. Now, that's true that this isn't exactly the same as prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. Nonetheless, there's certainly the sort of argument that could be made that these are modern virtues for a modern time. Although a cynic might say they're capitalist virtues for a capitalist time. So, how do we get to these modern virtues? Well, let's go to Friedrich Nietzsche. Friedrich Nietzsche looks at the concept of virtue, and he comes up with a number of really important ideas. And again, this is a full course in just a couple of minutes of explanation. But here are a few of the things that he does. He looks at the concept of the Übermensch, which we know now as Superman, and asks, basically, what would the ethics of a Superman be? If you had no constraints, what would your ethics be? And I think that's a good question. Now, the answer that we got, at least in the mid-30s in North America, is that if you had superpowers, what you would do is fight crime. Which seems like an odd thing to do, but I think that tells us a lot about the state of American society at the time, and rather less about the nature of Superman. But beyond that, Nietzsche has this idea of what is called the transvaluation of value. What if you took a value, such as, say, honesty, and you reversed it, so that being dishonest is considered to be the ethical thing, and being honest is maybe, say, a weakness or a lack of virtue somehow. And this is a bit of a caricature of Nietzsche's view, but it's close enough for our purposes here. You still have a system of morality, certainly not the one that we have, but one that could be defended pretty much on the same sort of grounds as the ones that we do actually have. And so there's this sense in which we need to understand morality as beyond basic definitions of good and evil. Beyond this 2,500-year-old philosophy of Zarathustra, which depicted the world in these terms of good and evil, right and wrong, and depicted the world as this endless battle between the two. And perhaps see virtue as something else. Now, we can depict it as what the Übermensch would do. Or we can say that it has to do with what your values are, what your character is, and what your nature is. Now, you can see how this could lead to some fairly bad results if put into the wrong hands. You can see how, for example, people might say that, a certain class of people that has a certain nature are more ethical than others. As a type of nationalism, say. And I think that would be a misinterpretation of what Nietzsche has in mind. In fact, I certainly do think it would be a misinterpretation. Nonetheless, that's what people have done. And you can also take this transvaluation of value and just say, you know, whatever the Superman does is good, and apply it to contemporary politics and the world of Donald Trump, in which lying is a virtue, stealing is a virtue, murder, if he could get away with it, would be a virtue, because the idea in a world like a Donald Trump world is you take what you can, and that politics isn't the art of negotiation and compromise. Politics is the art of leverage. And viewed from a certain perspective, that can be seen as good, and these can be seen as virtuous characters. Now, there's a danger in that kind of thinking, obviously, but it's not clear where the source of the danger is and how you address or resolve that danger. But I think it's reflective that the Superman's new motto, his old motto used to be truth, justice, and the American way, but now it's being depicted as truth, justice, and a better tomorrow. And we're told it's meant to inspire people from around the world. But I think that maybe it's because the American way found itself unable to distinguish between the ethics of a Donald Trump and the ethics of, say, I don't know who. Maybe that's part of the problem. Another aspect of character and mindset is the idea of role models. So on Wikipedia, and I admit I edited this sentence so that it would read properly. That's what you can do with Wikipedia. A role model is a person whose behavior, example, or success can be emulated by others, especially by younger people. The term role model is credited to sociologist Robert K. Merton, who hypothesized that individuals compare themselves with reference groups of people who occupy the social role to which the individual aspires, an example of which is the way young fans may idolize and imitate professional athletes or entertainment artists. Well, I think there's something to that. And I've talked about a theory, or maybe a way of looking at the world that I've had over the years, where the role models from, say, the 1940s were, well, even we can go back even before that, before the war, the role models were G-Men or FBI agents. And we had dramas like Dragnet, or even our anti-hero characters were people like Philip Marlowe. And then during and after the war, the role models were, well, soldiers, GIs. And that held on for a while. And then there was Sputnik, and all of a sudden, all of society did a 180, and role models were people like scientists. And we had science fiction depicting swashbuckling young heroes with slide rules on their belts. I stole that quote from somewhere. I don't know where it was from. And there was a time, maybe in the 1950s, maybe the 1960s, where the role model was the film star and everybody wanted to be famous. Or in the 60s and the 70s, where the role model was a rock star and everybody wanted to start a band. And in the 90s and into the 2000s, perhaps a more cynical age, the role models were, well, they've always been athletes, well, since the war. Perhaps before the war as well, but also people like businessmen or tycoons. And so you see people like Bill Gates or the founders of Google or Mark Zuckerberg held up as role models. And we can sort of see the problem with that as well. And you know, the idea of a role model isn't copying exactly what they are, but it's also, it's kind of a symbiotic relationship between the person who's in the role model role and the person who's using them as a role model. And, you know, it brings to mind the plaintive cry of the kid who says, "Say it ain't so, Joe," when Shoeless Joe Jackson is found to be part of the cheating Chicago Black Sox. Or even in more contemporary times, we have Aaron Rodgers, who just a couple of days ago was found to be just out and out lying about whether or not he was vaccinated. And again, you know, it's the fall of the role model. So, but it's a thing, and it very much has to do with virtue ethics, you know, and it's not about whether a person can throw a touchdown or whether a person can found a company or whether a person can land on the moon or whether a person can capture Berlin. It's about the properties, whatever they may be, and they're not always listed, that enable people to accomplish these great things. You know, I have a picture of, and I'll show it to you because it's worth showing, because it's on my wall right there. That's Jose Bautista. Now, we'll leave aside the fact that he's 30 or 35 years younger than me. But I have his picture there because it's a good role model. I look, and it's not because I want to be able to hit a baseball into outer space. It's because he emulates virtues that I think are worth following. In hockey, Doug Gilmore is an example of a role model for me. Somebody who shows the heart and grit and willingness to play through pain in order to help the team and achieve success. Now, that doesn't mean I think I should be, show the same sort of heart and grit and willingness to play through pain. I am not going to do anything on a broken leg. It's not going to happen. I don't want to emulate those virtues identically, but the model is something to work from. Not as an ideal, but as something to shape the way I see the world. And I think that's how role models kind of work. You can take that to extremes. There are ways of describing different personalities of people, and there have been no end to the personality type quizzes. In education we have the ongoing discussion of learning styles, and that's neither here nor there. What we do have, though, is this identification of a set of qualities of a person, sometimes thought of as innate or unchangeable, essential, in other words, or sometimes thought of as something that you can acquire or develop, or even sometimes just described as preferences, just sort of accidental, the way we ended up in life. But these can be depicted as valuable or not valuable. These can be depicted as virtues. Here we have the DICS personality types, and you can see basically what we've got here are four types of person who have four sets of virtues that they value. So the one is results-oriented, firm, forceful. The other one is outgoing, enthusiastic, optimistic. Another one is, and this is more like me, analytical, reserved, systematical, and precise. Boy, if you want systematical, look at this course. And another one is even-tempered, accommodating, patient, tactful. That's not me. Right? So you can see how these are lists of virtues, but it's almost like a menu that you can choose from. Over on the right-hand side, we've got the traditional Myers-Briggs personality types, and we can talk about whether those are real or not real, and it doesn't matter. But it's interesting because somebody has taken them and given them virtues and vice that are particular to the personality type. So for my personality type, which is INTP, a virtue would be attentiveness. And yes, I can be really attentive, but the vice is apathy. And yes, if I'm ignoring something or if I don't care about something, I really don't care about it. And that can be seen as a vice. And this sometimes is talked about explicitly in terms of virtue or vice. Here's an article that showed up in Futurity today, reporting on a study published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology, which said, I'm quoting from Futurity here, it showed participants with liberal and conservative political beliefs both shared erroneous news stories to a certain degree, but conservatives who also scored low on conscientiousness engaged in such behavior to a greater extent. They were more likely than liberals or more conscientious conservatives to share misleading information. So here what we have is the attribution of a vice or the absence of a vice to a certain group of people, or attribution of a virtue or non-attribution of a virtue to a certain group of people, and then associating it with in this case, a non-virtuous type of act. So, again, this shows how something like virtue ethics can be a bit misleading. And that takes us to the final slide. The final slide, which is the discussion of mindsets. And a mindset is kind of like a character trait, and it's kind of not like a character trait. It's a set of beliefs that shape how you make sense of the world and yourself. George Lakoff might think of mindsets in terms of frames, right? A frame, again, is how you see the world. What categories there are in the world, how cause and effects work in the world, what is your own personal nature, what are your own capabilities. And so we have things like the growth mindset, which sees our own abilities as something that can change rather than being fixed. The innovator's mindset, which we discussed earlier. Design mindset, which is represented here in a diagram, where your virtues are that you're built to think, you center your work around your users, you selectively pause feasibility, whatever that means. You take on a beginner's mindset, which is a mindset within a mindset. You embrace constraints, which is not what I do. I don't work within the box. I smash the box. I deny the existence of the box. Working with interdisciplinary teams, we see that talked about a lot in other kinds of mindsets. And thinking of everything as a prototype, well, you know, that's kind of like the founders or the startup mindset. And so there are all these mindsets, all these accounts of what count as virtuous. And we can think of the literature out there that talks about grit as virtue, resilience as virtue, entrepreneurship as virtue, etc. And I don't have a slide here talking about how virtue ethics can fail. But we can talk about that, and there are a number of ways. First of all, if we think of virtue ethics as a normative theory that tells us what's right and what's wrong, then it needs to take a stance on the deontic status of anything. In other words, it needs to take a stance on whether something is right or wrong. And then identify a set of right-making features. In other words, what makes something right? What makes something wrong? Right? You can't just list all the things that are right in the world and all the things that are wrong. The idea is if it's going to be a normative theory, they have some sort of characteristics. And it's these characteristics that tell us what virtue is. But the problem is, either it can't actually make this determination, or it will be thought of as implausible, because whatever it brings forward as defining rightness and wrongness will be less obviously right or wrong than the things it's defining right or wrong. Let's take honesty, right? Honesty is thought of as a virtue. And so a deontic theory would say you should act honestly. Or it might say something like you should be honest, right? A virtue theory would say you should be honest, but the outcome is you should act honestly. Okay, so there should be a reason for making honesty a virtue. But what is more obviously a virtue than honesty, that honesty would depend on that as a virtue? You know, anything that we could bring to mind as an argument in favor of honesty is less likely to be thought of as virtue than honesty is. So calling honesty a virtue hasn't really told us anything. And that's a problem. One of the other problems, and I'm sure you've already seen this, just in the way I've presented this subject, is that any number of different things can be listed as virtues, and there's no way to tell them apart. And it's kind of a variation of the first problem, but it's a variation because, you know, in the first problem, okay, nothing tells us that honesty is virtue. There's, you know, honesty is just a virtue. It's not in virtue of something that it's a virtue. Okay, that's fine. But now I have my alternative list. How do we determine which one is the correct list? Or maybe there are multiple lists, as in the case of the multiple personality styles. Or maybe something that is obviously a virtue to someone is obviously not a virtue to someone else. Think of an example, spirituality. Is spirituality a virtue or not a virtue? Or is it even possibly a vice? Ask different people and you will get different results. And so that's an issue. And then finally, I mean, I could go on with criticisms, but I'll add this one and we'll end it there. It doesn't really guide us in anything. I have my set of virtues. I'm honest, let's say. I'm charitable. I'm prudent. I watch out for my own interests, but I watch out for other people's interests. The set of values. And let's say I'm confronted with some issue. Let's take Philippa Foote's trolley problem. Philippa Foote describes it as, you've got a trolley, it's going down a track. If you pull the handle, you save the five people it was going to run over. But by putting it on a track, you're going to hit someone else. So what do? Well, the answer is you do whatever a virtuous person would do. Well, what would a virtuous person do? I don't know. And therein lies the problem, right? The only way to know whether or not you would pull that handle is to put a virtuous person in the position of having to pull that handle. The counterfactual is impossible to decide. But if you put a virtuous person in that position, doing that in itself is a very unethical act because you're going to kill someone. It's kind of like the squid games of philosophical problems. Someone's going to die. And is it ethical to be one of those people who's going to die? Or to not be one of those people who's going to die? Or to decide which person's going to die and which person's not going to die? All of these come up in the squid game. And all of these come up in life. And therein lies the problem with virtue ethics. The most virtuous person in the world still is left without a solution of how to answer the world's ethical problems. And that's why virtue as an ethical principle kind of receded after the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, as alternatives came along that would allow us to use our capacities, our faculties of knowledge and reason and experience to make these determinations. And it's interesting that we see a revival in virtue ethics today in the form of mindsets, in the form of personality types, in the form of role models, etc. And it's almost like it's a symptom of a society that's losing faith in the capacity of reason and wisdom and experience to tell us what's right and wrong. And we have to go back to what we were doing before we decided that reason and science would describe the way forward for us. So that's the first of these ethical principles, and I probably should have mentioned in my preliminary to this particular video that I might actually be talking about these longer than I really should, given the overall context of the course, but they're endlessly interesting to me, and I'm going to be constantly going off on diatribes, and it might put me behind in presenting the video material for the course, but I'm not going to worry about that because I'm going to take the effort that it takes in order to talk about each of these ethical issues appropriately. And if I fall behind, I fall behind. I mean, the only person setting the schedule here is me. So, and, you know, and it's not like I have a million people following the course. I know that's terrible, right? But again, it's me thinking and trying to decide between different alternatives. Happily, nobody lives or dies depending on my decisions on this. But I hope you enjoyed this discussion. And I hope you found things to agree with in it and disagree with it. And perhaps challenge my interpretations of different approaches and different theories. All of that is fine. It doesn't matter whether the presentation is the most expert, precise presentation in the world. What matters is that I've got enough of it in there so that I've given you something to think about and consider alternative possibilities, alternative ways of approaching ethical issues in learning analytics and AI in teaching and learning. So that's it for this video. Thanks a lot. I'm Stephen Downes, and I'll see you next time.